Hello, and welcome to the Business Decisions Podcast. My name is Stuart Wood. I'm the CEO of Caravel Law and your host for this podcast. Each episode, we explore issues that reside at the intersection of business and law. Today, I'm joined by Neil Seaman, the author of a recent book, Accelerated Minds, Unlocking the Fascinating, Inspiring, and Often Destructive Impulses that Drive the Entrepreneurial Brain. I'll have a link to the book in the show notes. Neil is also a successful entrepreneur himself. He was the founder and CEO of Rewe and is now the company's chairman. But that's only the start of Neil's bio. He has a law degree from the University of Toronto and had a brief legal career. He went on to get a Master of Public Health degree from Harvard. He is a senior fellow in the Institute of Health Policy Management and Evaluation in the Dalai Lama School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. In June of 2022, he was named a Fields Institute Fellow. He is also a senior fellow at Massey College and a senior academic advisor to the Investigative Journalism Bureau at the University of Toronto. So quite a bio. Neil, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Stuart. It's a great pleasure to be here with you. I consider you an entrepreneur and Caravel, a law firm for entrepreneurs. So it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
That's great. So writing a book like this is obviously quite an undertaking. What motivated you to write this book?
Thanks, Stuart. My dad. My dad passed away in 2021, and he had devoted his life to dopamine, the molecule in the brain, the neurotransmitter that affects how we cope meaning in our lives, why we take risk, and why we pursue reward. At the same time, I was interested in how this favorite molecule of my father's was affecting the brains of entrepreneurs, and because I was seeing some of the same behaviors that he was seeing in mentally ill patients sort of play themselves out in entrepreneurs. So I wanted to study the crossover, and it's really been a fascinating journey.
And one of the things that really comes across in the book is a sense of caring about entrepreneurs. I guess your background as an entrepreneur yourself, how did that influence the decision to focus on entrepreneurs and the effects of dopamine?
Yeah, that's a big, big part of it, Stuart. In my life, I've seen a lot of what I call quiet entrepreneurs who plod along, work steadily. They mostly fail at their ventures economically, and they try and try again. At the same time, I see the financial media, the tech media, often present non-representative entrepreneurs. The entrepreneurs I know, like 99% of them, are people who build something of lasting value for the communities they care about. And so I wanted to talk about them because those entrepreneurs, whom I call values-based entrepreneurs, they're the ones who are disproportionately dopamine sensitive. They're the ones whose dopamine can unduly affect them, lead them to major depression, often suicidal impulse, a range of conditions that are really concerning. And that issue hasn't really been paid attention to outside of the entrepreneurial community.
And why do you think society as a whole should care about entrepreneurs and their health?
Well, they're the OECD and many other institutions have identified entrepreneurs as the seed of our collective prosperity, and increasingly so. I mean, in Canada, the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor is putting entrepreneurs now at up to 20%, and the rate of growth among entrepreneurs, especially young entrepreneurs, new immigrant entrepreneurs, is really driving our collective prosperity. So we depend on these, what I call accelerated minds, for our collective prosperity. These people, these risk takers, often people who take irrational risks, extreme risks. And so, if you look at companies in the news now, NVIDIA, whole range of companies, these are people who took extraordinary risks on things that people laughed at the time. So in any event, we depend on them. But, beyond that, it's just important that for people to know that everyone, deserves attention in terms of their mental health challenges. I also define entrepreneurs more expansively than simply people who employ other people in a for-profit business. I also think of them in terms of creative artists, musicians in particular, artists of all kinds, nonprofit, social entrepreneurs. So we need to care about them. They're a large group and their families are a large group as well.
Yeah, I like that you highlighted that Neil Young is an entrepreneur.
Oh, absolutely. My goodness. Yeah, he's definitely a representative entrepreneur. Well, sort of the values-based entrepreneur that I consider.
Do you think that there's something specific about entrepreneurs that makes them afraid to show vulnerability and talk about struggles along the way?
We have every incentive not to talk about it in the entrepreneurial community. Investors often see it as a sign of weakness, or at least we perceive that to be the case. The media often represents us as perfect and infallible. And then we look at those people and we see ourselves differently. And so just the economic incentives can be oppositional to talking about our mental health struggles. It's just not consistent with certainly how Silicon Valley, Wall Street, the investor community understands their image of the ideal entrepreneur. I don't want to suggest that that's universal, though. There's a large number of investors, board members who do understand.
You don't often read in business magazines and business books about dopamine. You know, picking up on, you know, your father being your inspiration for this work, what should entrepreneurs know about dopamine?
Well, dopamine is the chemical neurotransmitter in our brain that affects what we often at a very, very young age coat with meaning, with salience. And then we take risks to achieve that. So for some of us, it's making money. For others, it's eating a particular type of food. And everyone's dopamine reactivity is different, and it can come in random bursts. It comes in what's called phasic stages. These random bursts are tonic phases, these steady flows. And so we need to regulate. And that is happening, right? So without knowing it, entrepreneurs, for example, have taken on a wide range of hacks to try to regulate their dopamine. So for example, ice baths are popular in Silicon Valley. Things like neuromodulation, deep brain stimulation, psychedelics. These are a wide range of things entrepreneurs are doing. I recommend what I call sort of philosophic constellation, spirituality in the larger sense of that word, talk therapy, or what Viktor Frankl talked about, logotherapy, and the contemplation of our own mortality, things that the Stoic philosophers talked about. As methods to really understand and empower all of us, not just entrepreneurs, to be more grounded and regulated in our dopamine overactivity.
And why do you think it's so important for entrepreneurs to unplug and get some peace and quiet every now and then?
Sort of, we're wired to be a little too dopaminergic, right? Intense and reactive. Often we're closer to Mike Tyson than Muhammad Ali in the match, right? And it's a long match. It's beyond 10 rounds. Most entrepreneurial ventures fail. And if you look at the data, sort of the data accumulated by places like CB Insights, entrepreneurial ventures often fail because of dopaminergic squabbles among founders, between founders and boards, founders and investors. That reactivity, that dopaminergic reactivity, can just have negative effects. And so that pause, that decluttering is really important to just getting perspective. And I think it's also empowering, and this is what I'm hearing from people who are reading the book and talking with me. I think it's empowering just to know that we are vulnerable. We talk a lot about work-life balance for wage workers, employees. That's absolutely important. And I'm really happy for that conversation to be taking place. At the same time, though, there's sort of a conspicuous gap. Like we're not talking about the employers, and the employers wear the emotions of their employees on their sleeve. I mean, this has especially been the case amid COVID. That's all the reasons just to unplug, unwind, see things with perspective, balance.
But we'll both know entrepreneurs who are fully and completely dedicated to the venture that they're working on. And one of the things you highlight in the book is how important determination and persistence is to an entrepreneur's success. How do you straddle that line between the grit and determination and all-encompassing focus that's needed to be successful with the need to get away from those real-time updates of your sales data and things like that to unplug and give yourself a break?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, Elon Musk is right on some things. And one thing I agree with him on, and many people say this, is simply that entrepreneurship by its nature is a 7-day-a-week job. You're always thinking about it, especially you see it as your progeny and that your baby. And I really believe that analogy holds forth. So you're always thinking about it. But I think we need to make a distinction between working really hard, 6 days a week, what have you, and that time out. Like even what I call these micro holidays, that can be taking a shower. It can be reading a book before you go to bed. It can be 5 minutes of meditative contemplation. So you can work that in. And even these little mini hacks can make a difference, right? To borrow the analogy of baby steps. They really do work. And different things work for different people, right? So I can't generalize. So it's not really the cumulative amount of hours that you work. It's really about the dedicated, contemplative nature of taking the mini sabbaticals, the micro holidays that you need to do. And one thing entrepreneurs know how to do is to step out of their comfort zone. So for an entrepreneur, a big step out of their comfort zone is actually to take a break. And so I think that message could potentially resonate with entrepreneurs and work to their advantage.
You also have external forces, such as any VCs you may have taken money from, who are looking to see that you're all in. You see this as particularly dangerous, right?
Yeah, there's a whole range of factors in the current investor ecosystem right now, whether it's institutional, non-institutional, that is increasing the expectation of speed of financial reward. Now, there are a wide range of investors that look at things differently in terms of long-term patient capital. But I do believe the expectation of fast reward and the values-based entrepreneur's desire to exercise their fiduciary duty to maximize returns for their shareholders amid this incredibly fast-paced environment that we have, it can just magnify their dopaminergic release. And so I do recommend a variety of tactics that we should consider in the investor ecosystem to slow the system down. And I do mean experiments. I'm not suggesting greater regulation, but I do believe, for example, we can look at term sheets and the disclosure of entrepreneurial mental health as being a fundamental risk to the business. We can look at committees of the board dedicated to mental health. We can look at the messaging that we send to new entrepreneurs and explain the risks inherent in entrepreneurial activity. What's been interesting to me thus far in the reception to the book is that young people in particular, and I'm defining this as sort of 16 to 30, it really resonates with them because they're really inclined to entrepreneurialism for a variety of reasons. They want to have control over their destiny financially. But at the same time, they're much more conversant in mental health topics and much more willing to talk about them than prior generations, our generation, for example.
And so is it just the founders and creators that you see with these effects? Does it affect other people who are involved in the entrepreneurial ecosystem, like VC investors, who obviously have perhaps more diversified risk as opposed to being all in on one particular venture, but are still, you know, would be theoretically addicted to some of the risk that's involved and the excitement and the constant energy of the environmental ecosystem?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a spectrum. I do believe founders are at particularly high risk. That being said, the investor community as well, a subset of them that do take high risk. I mean, we know from the research from Helen Pushkaraya at Yale that the early stages of a venture, when you're first telling your friends and family about your venture, your vision, the same thing with investors when they go all in right at the beginning. This is when the dopamine high state that my dad examined is most active in the brain. And so just like gambling addiction, this is what entrepreneurs are chasing. They're always chasing that early high that we had when we first talked about our idea, our vision, our venture. And that is incredibly motivating. I always say to entrepreneurs that when you're down, and you're often down, you know, to think back about why you started your venture in the first place, because that can be incredibly motivating. When you think about the community that you were trying to help, what you were trying to build, whether you succeeded or failed according to your own internal metrics.
The places where you're down, I think, you know, people who know entrepreneurs or are entrepreneurs can maybe more easily recognize some of the challenges that would come from a down period or struggles or having to shut down a venture, that kind of thing. But you highlight in your book a number of, you know, wildly successful entrepreneurs who've also struggled with demons along the way.
My view is that you kind of, and entrepreneurs tend to do this, like you sort of need a, but sometimes they don't do it enough. You sort of need a phalanx of really close friends and family around you whom you can turn to outside of the business for support, for emotional support. And those are people who can just help you see away from the blinders. Oftentimes it is an investor, which is interesting. Like sometimes you do have an investor who gets it. And that can be so valuable, both to the entrepreneur and to the investor, as a vehicle of communication. I do believe entrepreneurs also need to talk to one another. It's been very interesting on this journey too. Like a lot of entrepreneurs who are, some of them are household names in Canada and the United States, have sort of communicated with me and said, wow, you know, like this is really cool. You know, I didn't realize that it could be empowering to actually talk about your mental health struggles. I mean, it's interesting. I often think, Steve Ditko mentioned this, and I quoted him in the book. I mean, it, like, the vulnerability is often the characteristic we admire the most in our employees and others. And yet it's the vulnerability, like, that we're least willing to talk about, ourselves. And so what I found is that when I started to talk about my acute anxiety, and anxiety is a really tough thing for people to understand if you have it in an acute way, like I've had throughout my life, it really meets with a lot of support from unknown corners and quarters. I was very nervous when I wrote a reflective essay and Canada's sort of top medical journal, the Canadian, and one of the world's, the Canadian Medical Association journal, just talking about my own experience with anxiety. I was so nervous the night before it actually was being published. And yet, you know, the reaction was just so positive. You know, I mean, like, who knows? There must be people out there who might have taken it negatively, but I don't know any.
So the writing about anxiety first caused your anxiety to spike and then lessened it?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It was a strange experience. You know how it works in these peer reviewed papers, right? You write it and then it doesn't come out until maybe 6 to 8 months later. And then, so it was like the night before it was about to come out in print and online, that was when I started to get anxious. So it's sort of, you know, and look, anxiety and a whole range of these things can appear to the outside to be irrational, but we have some evolutionarily adaptive reasons for being anxious, for having these manifestations the way we do.
So do you think that part of the solution is just entrepreneurs knowing about dopamine and what sort of things could be going on and things they could be responding to and reacting to and influencing their behavior? Or is there other things that you'd recommend that entrepreneurs, you know, proactively do or to prepare themselves?
Yeah. So on the first point, I do believe simply being aware of the data, like, you know, 3 times more susceptible to addictions, anywhere from 5 to 10 times greater bipolar, a whole range of other phenomena can actually be quite empowering. I had one well-known entrepreneur who contacted me who said, "Neil, man, you saved my marriage." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "Well, I was finally able to communicate to my spouse, like when she saw the statistics and the data, you know, she understood, right? She understood what." And so that can be empowering in and of itself to know, and it can give you sort of self-actualization that you don't have complete control. I mean, we all know that randomness and good fortune is often the determinative variable in a company's success. Google was the 99th search engine. It was not the best. And it was almost sold for $750,000. And you know, everything changed. So not just $750,000 in 1999 was an insignificant sum, but it's just to suggest that, you know, the randomness is often a variable. And so dopamine is inherently random in terms of its burst and effect. On the second point, though, what can you proactively do? I mean, you can do a lot. I mean, I don't think I'm not really sure about these experiments that I recommend around changing the nature of short-termism in the investor ecosystem. I actually don't know if they'll work. They're recommendations to explore and evaluate. But on the personal level, we do have a lot of data from the mindfulness research, cognitive behavioral therapy, logotherapy, philosophic contemplation, meditation, neuromodulation. We do know that these things can work. We know from the research that when people are given dopamine-inducing drugs, they take more risk. And so being aware of it, but at the same time being aware of the nature of techniques to address it, I think can be empowering. And also creating more of an entrepreneurial community that is supportive of one another in these times that I think Ben Horowitz called the high highs and low lows twice in one day.
So if you put yourself in the shoes of your friend's wife who maybe wasn't as aware of the struggles, if you have an entrepreneur in your life, it could be a partner or a family member or a close friend, what are some of the things that you should watch out for or be mindful of or make it easy to talk about?
It's really interesting. That's a really important question. One point that I like to mention is that I feel we make a mistake in thinking about an entrepreneur as a single unit of one person. I believe an entrepreneur is often a couple who sort of trade off risks and talk about it. And I think the important thing, really important thing, is at the beginning of the entrepreneurial journey to really be very transparent with one another about the risks that you're taking and the realistic financial returns, because we're often departing from a kind of rational course in terms of our career to take a risk-taking venture. So that openness and transparency and check-ins are really important. I think the risk identification, it's often when you observe your partner being highly reactive to individual perceived attacks, which are rationally, objectively not accurate, sometimes delusions or even hallucinations around what's going on. These are big, big warning signs. I think the partner is really, really critical. In most entrepreneurial ventures that I've seen succeed commercially, the spouse has always been really supportive and caring. And that's why I say, like, the entrepreneurial unit really needs to be looked at as at least two. I mean, sometimes it can be the whole family, the kids and parents as well.
I'm curious, having been on an entrepreneurial journey yourself and being involved in supporting other entrepreneurs, what did you learn about yourself as you wrote this book?
The most important thing I actually learned is that I rediscovered my love of writing. And I love to write. And I come from a family of writers. And I learned that that writing a book is really the quintessential entrepreneurial journey. You know, you have a vision of what you're trying to write. You enlist a publisher, so you pass a market test, that publisher supports you. You get this small band of people supporting you. And it's really collegial. There's other writers writing lonely in lonely cubicles, and sort of you need to band together and support one another. You have no idea how the book's going to be received. You also have things entirely out of your control, like whether Amazon is going to make a mistake and not store your books on time, or whether the printing and distribution system and supply chain is going to work. Or whether or not somebody of note is going to pay attention to your book. Like, you really don't know. And you're also exposing yourself in a very public way, right? When you write about yourself. So it's a very public journey. So I was surprised, and that's what really sort of made me, very deeply appreciative of, how artistic people, writers, musicians, social entrepreneurs really need to be included in our definition of entrepreneur. We're like, you know, these technological wunderkinds in their 20s, they are a sliver of entrepreneurship, but they're hardly representative. So that was the biggest thing I learned about myself again. And I love it. So actually I'm planning and researching my next book already.
Have you, been able to avoid the urge to get real time sales updates on your books and read your reviews and get the dopamine hit?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. Actually, the biggest thing I learned is I've learned so much about Amazon. It's just so fascinating. Like, it's just all these interesting things. I mean, Amazon actually does not control the book universe as much as I thought. I thought it was 100%. It's close to that. And then beyond that, it's actually really interesting. I don't know if you've ever read, but for any entrepreneur listening or anybody listening, I encourage them to read Jeff Bezos's annual shareholder letters in the 1990s. They were so incredibly inspiring. They were sort of like, hey guys, stick with me. E-commerce will be something. It'll be big. You know, I know you don't believe me now, but it'll be big. And they were eloquently written. They were nice. I'm not sure if the Jeff Bezos of the mid-1990s would necessarily be sort of in sync with the Jeff Bezos, like the Amazon of today, in terms of how it's manifesting in terms of the publishing industry, let's call it. But that being said, I became intellectually very intrigued with Amazon's business model and the publishing business model. It's extremely interesting. People often say, oh, it's dead, it's dying, and AI is going to destroy it. I disagree. I actually think that if anything, AI and generative AI is going to really promulgate the importance of personal stories that are otherwise inaccessible from an AI. So in any event, I that's how I deal with it. I have no doubt that there's others who fixate on it, on the actual sales.
I always find it interesting when people who take lessons from other fields and bring it to a new field. And so you see books by poker players about business and rock climbers about business. And I learned about you in this book that you were a boxer, and you reference rolling with the punches quite a bit. What have you learned from boxing that you've brought to your entrepreneurial journey?
Well, first, let me tell you that I would not necessarily recommend boxing as a sport. I took it up actually because I did not like karate, and then I met a guy who was a mixed martial artist, and he was just like a nice guy, and so he trained me in boxing. I had a lot of fun actually boxing with lawyers and accountants. Mm-hmm. We're not exactly talking about heavy duty stuff here, but anyway. Point is what I learned. Okay, so yeah, it's interesting. What's really interesting about boxing is that there's a big difference between sparring and actually getting into the ring, and or even boxer size versus sparring. And once you start to spar, really, and the punches come, you learn that you have all these preconceived biases about what it's, you know, so when you're fighting a lefty, if you're a righty, you sort of assume, oh, the lefty's going to behave this way. Or if you're fighting somebody who used to serve in the army, you'll assume X, Y, and Z about them. A whole range of biases enter really quickly into the human brain. So you need to pull back. And that's why, and so I find the history of boxing really interesting. And that's why, you know, it's empirically the case that Muhammad Ali was the best boxer of all time, because it wasn't the strength of his punch. It was the ability to dance and know the distance intuitively of whom he was boxing with. So, that I think is applicable and transferable.
No, that's great. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Neil. The book is really interesting. It prompts a lot of questions, but in particular, as I highlighted at the beginning, it really comes across, you know, how much you care about entrepreneurs and want to help people who are on that journey. So I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us about it today.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Stuart. I really enjoyed it. And I love Caravelle. You guys are you think in an entrepreneurial way. The economics of law is also really interesting too, by the way. Anyway, thank you, and really enjoyed this. Thank you.
All right. I want to thank my guest, Neil Seaman, the author of Accelerated Minds, Unlocking the Fascinating, Inspiring, and Often Destructive Impulses That Drive the Entrepreneurial Brain. If you're interested in purchasing the book, there's a link in the show notes. I thought it was a very interesting and thought-provoking book and would recommend it to the audience. The Business Decisions Podcast was created by the team at Caravelle Law. If you're interested in learning more about Caravelle Law, please visit us at caravellelaw.com. Special thanks to Dwayne Wright for mixing and producing this podcast. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed the discussion, please leave us a review and share the podcast with others that you think would be interested as well. And until our next episode, I hope all of your business decisions are great ones.